This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is the Today in Parliament podcast for Friday, July the 14th. I'm Mark Darcy. In this edition, the first Brexit bill has begun its passage through Parliament. How will it fare?
I think it'll be a white-knuckle ride. I think it's going to be a very interesting time.
The new set of select committee chairs have all been elected. Is this a new dawn for the cross-party cooperation voters are apparently clamouring for?
They want people to work together to get things done for the national interest, and I think the select committees can really step up to the plate on that.
And should the Commons set the rules and choose the chairs for public inquiries?
The opposition could put down a motion on an opposition day to challenge the whole basis of the inquiry. Parliament, in the end, holds government to account.
But first tonight, a month into the new Parliament, and the first green shoots have appeared on the bare branches of the Commons Select Committee system. In a new House of Commons with a precarious balance between a minority government and the opposition, the reports and verdicts of these committees will matter a great deal. And that's been reflected in an unusually competitive set of elections for the chairs of those committees. One of the successful candidates was the Conservative former minister Robert Halfon, running for the chair of the Education Committee on a manifesto emphasising the role of apprenticeships and training in creating ladders of opportunity. And he made a ladder the symbol for his campaign.
I didn't do a lot of telephoning. Some colleagues telephoned, but I actually thought it was better to meet people face to face. I was at the polling station, or the room that the voting station was, all day almost yesterday, and I had a great seat just by the door, and as the members walked in, I gave them a copy of my ladder, which said all the things that I hoped that we were able to look at if I had been elected.
Once upon a time, these elections tended to be quite sedate affairs, dominated by heavyweight ex-ministers and crabbed backbenchers of vast seniority. No more. Not only have there been big fields of impressive candidates running for major committee posts, but many of them have been relatively junior MPs, defying the hierarchical traditions of the House. More shocking still, some incumbent chairs were challenged. On Wednesday, the Speaker announced the results.
In the contested elections, a total of 587 ballot papers were submitted, the ballots being counted under the alternative vote system. The following candidates were elected. Backbench Business, Ian Mearns. Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, Rachel Reeves. Communities and local...
Well, perhaps the biggest prize in these elections was the chair of the Treasury Committee, vacated at the last general election by the Conservative Andrew Tyrie. It was won by the former Treasury Minister, then Education Secretary, Nicky Morgan, who was a leading Remainer in last year's referendum. So was her election, and that of others, the revenge of the Remainers.
One of my nominees, or people nominating me, was Michael Gove, who I think one would definitely know is not a Remainer. I think I had support from across the House. Hopefully people reflected on my Treasury experience, the fact that I've been a Cabinet Minister, 16 years experience in the City of London, and I had made my views clear about policy over the course of the last 12 months, including on the EU, and I think they knew that I would continue to do that and to ask the questions that other MPs want asked.
The other big issue confronting the Treasury Committee will be whether the era of austerity is, or should be, over. Should the Chancellor, in the light of the election result, water down attempts to cut government borrowing?
I don't get any sense from what the Chancellor has said, that he thinks that the efforts to reduce the deficit and then eventually to pay down the debt are by any means over. But I'm sure that we will want to ask him about the decisions that he's taking. And of course, we've got a budget coming in the autumn, and the committee will be heavily involved in scrutinising that.
Now, the chair of the other key economic committee, Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, or BEIS for short, was taken by the Labour former shadow cabinet member, Rachel Reeves.
My whole background before I became a Member of Parliament, working as an economist and then in business, and then the work that I've done over the last 7 years as a Member of Parliament, always focusing on those issues of the economy, finance, business, work. I think that I'm well qualified and suited to do this role, and I'm really looking forward to getting stuck in on a huge range of issues that are crucially important to the future direction of our country.
So does she see herself as part of a new generation taking over the committee corridor?
There will be a range of new ideas and perspectives from members of Parliament who have been here for just a few years. And in that respect, the baton is being passed. But there are also some of the more experienced chairs coming back, people like Frank Field at the Department for Work and Pensions. And I hope that in a number of areas there will be working across committees, for example, between Frank Field and myself on the issues of self-employment.
She expects her committee will be taking a close look at the newly published Taylor Review into the labour market and employment law.
In some ways, I don't think the Taylor Review goes far enough. I think in some areas, for example, on being paid the minimum wage as a self-employed person, I think that Matthew Taylor could have gone further. But I think we need a little bit of clarity from the government that they are now determined to crack down on issues of bogus self-employment and afford the protections to those people who are self-employed but look very much like directly employed members of staff.
Now, some Commons eyebrows have been raised at the sight of recent ministers like Nicky Morgan and Robert Halfon moving smartly into plum select committee roles, not least because they could end up scrutinising policy decisions they themselves took as ministers. Nicky Morgan left office with David Cameron back in 2016, while Robert Halfon was an education minister as recently as June. But he doesn't think there's a problem.
I have huge respect for my former boss, Secretary of State Justine Greening, I got on really well with, but I have a passion for education. This enables me to continue to work in the education area, to look at way we can scrutinise the policies of the government to make sure that they're helping the people from disadvantaged backgrounds and that they are improving our productivity and get everyone on that ladder of opportunity.
The committees are still some way from starting work. The chairs have been elected, but the ordinary members will only start to emerge next week. They're chosen from within their party groups. Labour's process will be completed on Monday night. But what are the qualities the committee chairs will be looking for in their new members? Nicky Morgan again.
Curiosity is a good thing. The ability to ask the questions and to unpick, not necessarily to arrive with particularly either preconceived ideas or agendas. Also, they have to be able to constructively challenge the chair, for example, and to point out, actually, this is an inquiry that does need to happen and we should be doing it sooner rather than later, as well as building alliances. So you want people who are complementary, but who are going to work together as a team. I think that is important.
Nicky Morgan, Sir John Chilcot on Iraq, Lord Saville on Bloody Sunday, the Hillsborough inquiry. When the state investigates disaster or wrongdoing, one thing's essential, that the public in general and victims in particular have confidence that the inquiry is conducted without fear or favour. And as two major new inquiries are launched into the decades-old contaminated blood scandal which killed at least 2,400 people, and Sir Martin Moore-Bix into the Grenfell Tower fire with its estimated 80-plus casualties, those issues are surfacing again. This is the Kensington Labour MP, Emma Dent Code, setting out what her constituents wanted from the Grenfell Tower inquiry.
This horrific event must be a game-changer. We need a thorough review of approaches to estate development, of funding of social housing, and we need to listen to the people affected and their warnings, act upon their concerns and their priorities with the transparency and honesty that has so clearly been missing. Grenfell people do not want your pity. Grenfell people do not want charity. They want their dues, they want justice, and they want change.
So who should decide who presides over an inquiry and what precisely they'll be asked to inquire into? Their terms of reference. At the moment, it's the government. But would there be more confidence if it was Parliament? The Conservative Bernard Jenkin has just been re-elected as the chair of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Select Committee, which has long called for Parliament to decide these issues. And he warns that MPs could take matters into their own hands.
There clearly is and should be a much bigger role for Parliament. We recommend that if the government's going to set up an inquiry, they should set up a special standing committee to look at the remit, to do a pre-appointment hearing of the chairman, and to hold the whole inquiry accountable and give Parliament ownership of the inquiry. Now, that's not the legal position of a statutory inquiry under the 2005 Act, but it is the political reality. It is quite possible, even though the government are conducting this in the traditional way, that we will finish up with a vote on the floor of the House of Commons on the remit, on an amendable motion, perhaps challenging the chairmanship, unless all the interested parties are involved and engaged in the formation of the inquiry.
Are you suggesting perhaps that the opposition's going to do it, or might there even be Conservative MPs who'd be keen to attempt to change the nature of the inquiry if it wasn't what you wanted?
Well, I'm not speculating about that. I'm simply saying that it is entirely possible that, for example, the opposition could put down a motion on an opposition day to challenge the whole basis of the inquiry. Parliament, in the end, holds government to account for the way they set up inquiries. And the challenges that are being made about the remit, you know, it should be much wider, it's got to deal with the emergency response afterwards, it's got to deal with social housing policy. I mean, these some of these challenges are making impossible demands on what needs to be done by a judicial inquiry into the causes of the fire and the lessons to be learned from that. Lord Cullen did the Paddington inquiry, which started in a very similar atmosphere of blame, recrimination, demands for prosecutions and so on. He had quite a narrow remit, but he nevertheless came up with very big transformational changes in the way safety is managed on the railway. And I would expect a Cullen-style inquiry that transforms the safety management of residential buildings with regard to fire risk. But that doesn't detract from the necessity of the Morbick inquiry closely to involve the victims and those affected in that inquiry. All the lessons of incident investigation is those affected have to be involved in the process. Otherwise, people feel excluded and their voice has not been heard. And very often, the people most affected have thought most about it and have some very, very important things to add to the inquiry. So that is absolutely essential. But yes, the government should set up at least a public working party to look at why the Civil Contingency Secretariat was so slow to respond to what was, in fact, a national emergency. There was no way that a single local authority could deal with a disaster on that scale with such huge political impact. And clearly, there is great and widespread concern about social housing policy, particularly in London. And the Prime Minister has said earlier this week that she wants to work with other parties and have their ideas to deal with the challenges that we're facing in the country at the moment. Here is a perfect opportunity to say, well, let's have a royal commission to look at social housing policy in inner cities and how asylum seekers are housed and how and all that sort of thing, involving a consensus approach of who's on this royal commission, and let's see what it comes up with. Some very good things used to come out of royal commissions. We tend not to have royal commissions these days. I think we should have one.
On the issue of personnel, there's been a lot of suspicion, the idea that unless the right person's in charge of an inquiry, it's going to be an establishment fix and the crucial questions won't be asked or answered.
Well, this is all about trust, isn't it? After a disaster like this, as we saw after Paddington, as we saw after Piper Alpha, the trust is right out the window. Nobody trusts anybody and everyone thinks that everything's a cover-up. And indeed, we are still dealing with the lack of trust on the contaminated blood scandal. And until people are involved in what they can see is demonstrated to be an impartial and open process, you won't get that trust. So it's a big challenge for Morbick to build up that trust, and it would be easier for him to build up that trust if he wasn't also fending off demands for these much wider issues to be considered, which, frankly, a judicial inquiry could not consider. The question of social housing in London is a highly political issue. That is not the subject that lends itself to a judicial inquiry.
Bernard Jenkin. Yesterday, MPs had their first glimpse of controversies to come as the bill that will dominate parliamentary life in the autumn was formally, if a little chaotically, presented.
Order. Presentation of bill. Mr. Secretary Davis, Mr. Minister Baker.
European Union withdrawal bill. Withdrawal.
Second reading what day?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Order.
Yes, the European Union Withdrawal Bill, what used to be called the Great Repeal Bill. It's one of the key measures needed to implement last year's referendum decision, and it's now been published. It'll probably get its first proper debate in September. It was hailed by the Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom.
This is one of the most significant pieces of legislation that has ever passed through Parliament, and it is a major milestone in the process of our withdrawal. It means we'll be able to exit the European Union with maximum certainty, continuity and control, That is what the British people voted for, and it is exactly what we will do. Thank you.
The idea is that the bill puts 40 years of accumulated EU laws into British law so that Parliament can then amend or unravel or repeal so that they suit Britain's post-Brexit needs and they fit into whatever deal is reached with Brussels. Simple in principle, but rather complicated in practice and requiring some sweeping powers for ministers. Stephen Laws is a retired parliamentary counsel, one of the specialist lawyers who draft legislation.
It's going to be quite a short bill, but it's going to require powers by ministerial order to deal with a lot of very complex material and in ways that aren't always predictable at the moment. I mean, in particular, the deal. We are not going to know what the deal is by the time the power to implement the deal has been drafted and approved by Parliament. And yet it's got to cover something that is as yet unknown.
So it's a sort of sky's the limit set of statutory powers, really?
Well, that's the difficulty, because there's the political difficulty of getting through a power that is so wide that it deals with anything you might not have thought of, because parliamentarians may think that it's so wide it might be used for purposes that they wouldn't have approved of.
So it may well be that the main area of debate on this, it won't be at all about the principle of Brexit, it will be about the ground rules for implementing it. And you can imagine people in Parliament pushing for the strongest possible scrutiny and oversight of the way ministers use those powers.
I think there are going to be two real main areas of controversy. The first is the power to implement the deal, because what deals people are prepared to accept is a matter of political controversy. And they are likely to use the passage of this bill in Parliament to want to discuss what deals are possible and which deals they would like to see. And the other is the extent to which the power to change things as part of the continuity provision, how far that power goes, because although in principle the government is saying it doesn't want to change policy, it doesn't want to change the EU law it's bringing forward for after Brexit, it wants to do that later on. The distinction between what you need to do in order to carry it forward and make it work if we're not a member and changing it is certainly, in certain cases, going to be difficult to draw clearly.
As a parliamentary counsel, the kind of person who used to draft laws for a living, how sort of knotty and attractive or unattractive a challenge is this for you?
The way you think about bills when you're drafting them is that the way policy normally works, ministers have decided they want a change in the real world and there's a legal obstacle to achieving it. So they want the legal obstacle removed in a way that will enable the change in the real world to occur. And this is different from that in a way because it's a system change. The idea is that we will change the system and what will emerge in the real world will be better because we will have a better system. And the complication of that is that it provides you with a lot more options. If, for example, you're setting out from the east coast of the United States, the choice of options is smaller if you're heading for Los Angeles than if you've decided that your destination is the Pacific Ocean. And it's very much the same here. There's a much more imprecise destination, and that gives you more difficulty about choosing the route.
Stephen Laws. And might the bill face political perils too? I asked David Jones, the former Brexit minister, if any of his Conservative MP colleagues could possibly vote against it.
No, I think that that would be really very difficult for Conservative backbenchers to rebel. Bear in mind that the whole of the parliamentary party, with the exception of Ken Clark, voted for the notification of withdrawal bill, which was the bill that led to the triggering of Article 50 in the first place. So it would look extremely odd, not to say incoherent, if Conservative backbenchers now tried to scupper the important repeal bill, which of course is going to make our legal system work on the day that we leave the European Union.
The classic tactic for people who want to make trouble on a bill of this magnitude is to cheerily vote for the second reading of the bill, but then to make difficulty over the programme motion for the detailed discussion later on. A manoeuvre last seen, I think, with the Lords Reform Bill that Nick Clegg brought forward during the coalition period. Do you anticipate that there might be games of that kind played?
I think that there might be threats of that, but I would be very surprised if they were actually carried through. I think that probably the more problematic stage of the bill is going to be the committee stage, when I have no doubt that there'll be an awful lot of amendments, and that will really be guerrilla warfare.
Does the government basically have to try and call the opposition's bluff on this?
I think they do, and I think that they have to keep reminding the opposition that they too voted for the bill that led to the triggering of Article 50. So to that extent, the opposition, or at least the Labour opposition, is in it just as much as the government. At the moment, of course, we don't know precisely what they will do, but I think that anything that looked irresponsible would probably rebound on the Labour Party themselves.
Have you any idea what the timescale for getting this bill through will be? It doesn't look like we're going to see the second reading until October.
That's right, and I would guess that it's going to take at least 9 months and possibly longer.
And beyond that, of course, there's a whole flotilla of other Brexit bills. Are they all going to be subject to the same kind of guerrilla warfare?
I would hope not. It depends how contentious these are perceived to be. But, for example, one of them is the Nuclear Safeguards Bill. I would have thought that everybody would want that one to go through if they are indeed concerned about the transportation of nuclear isotopes.
There's hope and then there's experience. While you might hope that there's not going to be a lot of guerrilla warfare on a lot of these bills, do you in reality anticipate there will be?
I think it'll be a white-knuckle ride. I think it's going to be a very interesting time.
Lots of late nights, knife-edge votes, sudden deals with minor opposition parties along the way.
Possibly also maybe Friday sittings and curtailed recesses. There's a lot to look forward to.
David Jones. First, it was the Queen's Speech Amendment on abortion funding from the Labour MP Stella Creasy, which forced ministers to make concessions when Conservative backbenchers showed signs of rebellion. Now, will plans to pull Britain out of the European Atomic Agency, Euratom, provide the next issue where ministers are forced to retreat? Sabres were being rattled pretty loudly in a Westminster Hall debate on Wednesday, where a number of Conservatives spoke out. This was the former Minister Ed Vasey questioning the government's legal case for pulling out.
We served our intention to leave Euratom on a technicality. It was quite clear that the government had received legal advice which put it into their minds that it might be an ineffective service of the Article 50 notice if we didn't serve notice that we were also leaving Euratom. The trouble we have, those of us who support our membership of Euratom, is none of us have seen that legal advice.
The Energy Minister, Richard Harrington, did his best to offer reassurance.
The rest of the UK's future relationship with Euratom will be subject to negotiations, obviously, with the EU and Euratom. And our primary aim throughout these will be to maintain our mutually successful civil nuclear cooperation with Euratom and the rest of the world. I must reiterate, we're strong supporters of Euratom, and that is not going to change.
Euratom regulates the nuclear industry across Europe, safeguarding the transport of nuclear materials, disposal of waste, and carrying out research that includes nuclear materials for energy and for medical use, like radiotherapy. So one way or another, the UK needs to access its services, either as a member or perhaps as some kind of associate member. Lib Dem MP Leila Moran, whose Oxford constituency is home to staff at a major nuclear research facility.
I spent the hour and a half listening to Conservative MPs saying that we should stay in, Labour MPs saying the same thing, I made the same case, and then in the end we had the Minister who said, oh no, everything's fine, but we are listening. And what we've seen now is that the government has backpedaled to a degree. It'll be interesting to see how far they will eventually go. I think the best solution would be to just simply accept limited amounts of ECJ jurisdiction and stay in altogether. Failing that, an associate membership of Euratom is acceptable as a compromise, but we need to start that process now. The last time that these kinds of things were negotiated, it took literally 2, 3, 4 years. We don't have that time. We've got less than two. So we really need to get our skates on if we're going to avoid, frankly, a big, big mess.
The Labour MP, Albert Owen, was part of that cross-party pressure during the debate. He could see whips and ministers taking notice.
There's no majority. It's as simple as that. And they have to listen to their own backbenchers. This debate, I think, really highlighted that there is a consensus between the parties on many big issues across the United Kingdom. And, you know, the government has said it wants to work with everybody and it wants a economic policy for the whole of the United Kingdom going forward and Brexit. And this is an example where it could do just that.
But for the government, the key voices are those of its own MPs, and a number are clearly worried. Conservative John Howell.
Quite frankly, there are a number of us who are very restless about this issue because it seems to us to be quite a simple issue and one that the government can quite easily decide on. So I hope that they are in listening mode and I hope that they're going to listen very carefully.
And as the government whips ponder how to deal with this latest outbreak of backbench dissent, the Lib Dem Leila Moran's planning for more cross-party cooperation.
What we'll see now is even more movement. There is talk about maybe, you know, doing some more cross-party working. There was an idea of a cross-party committee of some description or a working group that could work on this together for the government. And I think there would be a lot of appetite for that now.
Leila Moran. And that's it for this penultimate week before the summer parliamentary recess. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Mandy Baker. And that was Today in Parliament.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.